The sense of smell is one of the most powerful and least understood of our senses. Avery Gilbert has dedicated his professional life to researching and teaching others about this fascinating human olfactory system. He's a sensory psychologist who has published scientific papers, worked in both academia and the corporate world, and he joins us now to talk about his first book, which is called What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. It's published by Crown. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
You begin your book by asking the question, how many smells are there? Hasn't science already figured that out?
Nobody's ever counted. And in fact, the more you think about it, the crazier it is to actually go and enumerate the smells in the world. It's a serious question, though. It stems from the question of how many types of smells would there be, and how do you classify smells?
We've done that with taste, haven't we? And taste and smell are really tied together.
I'm a smell chauvinist, so I think taste is really simple. I mean, it's sweet, sour, salty, bitter, and now umami. Umami's joined the canon. My Japanese friends were always claiming that umami was a unique taste, and by God, it is. It's got its own receptors on the tongue. But that's five channels, and we've got 350 different receptors for smell in the nose. So it's a much more complex thing. In fact, most of our food aroma comes from it. But the idea of classifying smells goes back to Linnaeus, who is the big biological classifier. And people for centuries have tried building on his classification. And it turns out that's been a wild goose chase for three centuries because he was a little kooky. In his terms, he was looking for medicinal properties of plants. And he thought that he could tell what would be a good medicinal plant by how it smelled. So his interest in smell was strictly limited to things that would perk you up or purge your guts of a bad disease or something like that. And that he made no attempt to kind of cover all the smell rainbow.
So you threw him out, and you did your own research to some degree. How much original research did you conduct?
Well, this book is not just my research. This book, I cover all my friends and colleagues in the field. And there's about 600 people in the United States and a few hundred more in Europe who study smell and taste. And there have been a lot of advances in the last decade especially. And the public doesn't know about it. So that was my main thing here, was just to get that across, the work they've been doing.
Anybody who's watched a pet knows that they have much more sensitive senses of smells than humans do. How do our olfactory abilities compare with other species?
Well, you know, we tend to undersell ourselves dramatically. The latest work shows that we're about as sensitive as a dog. Now
I'm just not willing to put my nose into some of the things my dog has been willing to smell.
Right. Well, on a molecule for molecule basis, we're quite good. So we could compete at detecting, say, what a drug dog detects for the cocaine residue in an airport. Now we just don't devote as much of our brain to analyzing the smell signal from our nose as a dog does. Dogs have other advantages. But we are quite sensitive, and so we shouldn't sell ourselves short, even though people like Freud and others have for years just said it was a vestigial sense. It somehow smells like the appendix.
Have humans evolved specific olfactory abilities?
Yeah, there I argue strenuously in the book that our mouth, in fact, our eating habits and cooking habits have shaped our nose. They've actually, I think, selected for the ability to smell certain things, because when you think about it, modern humans walked out of Africa about 100,000 years ago. And then about 20 to 15,000 years ago, we started domesticating grains and domesticating animals. That meant when we started cooking grains, we had toasted notes of breads, of gruel. We had fermented notes of yogurt, butter, cheese, alcohol, all these things that came from settling down. These were new smells to the world. They were never in the world before, and they were very important to us. And I think that not only has our face physically been shaped, a smaller jaw, smaller teeth, a more agile tongue, but we've become tuned to these very particular smells of cooking and spicing that are a biological necessity now, not just a cultural frill.
Do all animals have a link between a sense of smell and sense of taste?
No, that's the interesting thing. I think if you look at a dog and how a dog eats, they gulp. Predators just rip, chew, and gulp. And we are the ones that savor. We really take our time with our food, and there's a whole separate way of smelling through the back of the throat, forward through the nose, that provides you the aroma of wines and fine food. You plug your nose when you're eating, and you don't get much.
We had that. We did a smell taste test on the show some years back, and we put nose clips on and some very powerful jelly beans in our mouths had absolutely no taste whatsoever until we took the nose clips off, and then we, wow, that's a really strong coffee taste or really strong licorice taste. So smell is a key to our sense of taste.
Absolutely. I think we tend to think of it as a unified thing. We think of taste. I mean, taste is basically, well, we think of flavors as something that occurs in the mouth, but flavor is really a combination of taste and smell. And it's the unity of it is really a mental illusion, I think.
Now, there are people who have trained senses of smell. Are they naturally better equipped to do that sort of thing, or is this something that can be learned?
That's something I talk about at length in the book. Kind of, is there such a thing as a smell genius, for example? The best example is our perfumers, and it turns out
mostly women do the smelling and perfume companies.
Increasingly, women, although historically it's been a male profession, and it was handed down. It was kind of a closed guild since the Renaissance in Italy, and it's handed down father to son. But now more women are coming into it. There's no reason why not. But perfumers don't need a particularly acute nose. They don't need to be very sensitive. What they need is a way of thinking. They need to be able to remember smells. They need to be able to imagine them in their heads. If you have a flair for smell, like you have a flair for color, then, you know, if you have a flair for color, you can become a designer or a painter. If you have a flair for smell, then you become a perfumer. But your nose need not be, you know, an order of magnitude better than anybody else's.
And the same would hold true for an enologist?
Yep. The wine people, chefs particularly, they talk about, to hear chefs talk, Charlie Trotter talks about making new dishes as being kind of a form of jazz composition. You know, you take a few basic riffs, you play them against each other, and you come up with interesting combinations. And he does it all in his head first and then plays it out in the kitchen.
And chefs often rely on their sense of sight and smell to know whether something is cooked. They don't have to taste it.
That's right. I mean, that's smell. In fact, the smell of food cooking sets off a whole series of physiological responses. You know, your pancreas starts secreting insulin. You've got digestive juices. A lot happens. Nathaniel Hawthorne once said that a good smell of cooking is both an invitation and a stimulus to appetite. And he's got some great accounts of feasts in the House of Seven Gables that I love. I think he loved to eat.
Well, obviously, a lot of writers have relied on sense of smell. Proust did pretty well with that as well, because smell will bring back all sorts of memories, evoke memories that some of the other senses won't.
Smell is good at bringing back in a flash something you haven't thought about for years. So you can walk through a machine shop, say, and suddenly, bingo, you're back in your grandfather's garage, you know, with the tools and the solvents and the oils out there. What is remarkable about that is how fast it is. It's like somebody flips a switch, and how complete the memory is. You're transported in time. The weird thing about Proust, who's become sort of the poster boy for olfactory memory, what he describes in the novel and Swan's Way is much different. It's this laborious. He has a sip of linden tea and a Madeleine, the famous Madeleine cookie dunked in it, and he struggles for minute after minute. It goes on for four pages until he can remember where he was and what it was about. But that's not what most people think about when they think about smell memory. So I think he's a poor mascot.
Avery Gilbert is a psychologist and smell scientist. He has written a book called What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life. It's published by Crown. What is a sensory psychologist? Do you have to go through special training, take a sensory psychology 101 course in college?
If only. Most people in the field back into it or go into it sideways. It's sort of like perfumery. My interest was in biology and animal behavior, and a lot of that involves smell. Animals sniff each other to find out who's friend, who's foe, who's family, who's interested in sex and who's not. And from there it evolved, and I got recruited into the perfume industry, which was the last thing that was on my mind. But
so did you develop perfumes?
I worked with the perfumers who did that. I did a lot of consumer research to find out what people liked, why people had the preferences they did. And
you've also done that with kitty litter.
It runs the gamut. You know, today's high haute couture perfume becomes tomorrow's kitty litter as the trickle down happens.
Now, I would assume that if you were to ask me about how many smells there are, I would say that there's probably a limited number of base smells, and then everything else is a combination.
Well, there is one theory that you have elemental smells in the same way you have primary colors. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to be the case because there are so many different receptors. That could mean we had 350 different elementals. What I think there are categories like floral, fruity, woody, and then on the dark side of things, you know, fecal and Uranus and vomit and spoiled fish. But perfumers managed to classify all of the nice things in the world into about anywhere from a dozen to 20 at the most. And I think if you had the dark side, you're talking about a couple dozen categories and you've covered odor space.
Are some people better at smelling than others?
Definitely.
You told me earlier that you actually have a gap. You can't. You don't get truffles.
I don't get androstenone, which is the key musky note in truffles. Everybody's got some gaps. These are called specific anosmias. That's the jargon in psychology. But basically, it's a very precise gap in your tuning curve. So it's as if you couldn't hear C sharp, one octave up. Everybody's got some of these gaps. It's like a little mini color blindness. Perfumers have them. They learn to work around them. The one I have is not particularly rare. About half people, if you shove a truffle up their nose, will just have no particular smell reaction. But clearly, people
are
willing.
The rest of us, like me, go crazy.
Yeah, and you're willing to pay $4,000 a pound for the experience.
Well, I'm not willing to spend the money, but I'm glad if somebody else gives me a little taste. What about pheromones, which many animals and insects secrete for sexual attraction? So I've read conflicting reports as to whether we actually sense them or not, or whether we even secrete them or not.
It's kind of a vexed topic. We definitely, let's put it this way. The other primates, monkeys and apes, have this special organ in the nose. It's a little adjunct to the nose that picks up these sexual chemicals. There's debate about whether we have one, and if we do have one, whether it's functional. So it could be like the appendix in the gut, which serves no particular purpose today, but it might have. On the other hand, there seems to be good evidence that, say, axillary secretions, armpit smells, can cause women to coordinate their menstrual cycles. There are things about smell and mate choice that are definitely shown that have relationships to genetic factors. So something is going on, but it's kind of at the edges rather than as dramatic it might be for pigs or other animals.
Aren't there also changes in the way we perceive those things? For example, armpit smells might have been sexual stimulants 150 years ago. Today, we would say, why don't you use a deodorant?
There's been some change in that, but I think there's still some debate about what the evolutionary advantage was. It might always have been sort of a individual recognition and scent marking cue rather than simply an incitement to copulation.
Do you think that that certain smells attract people to each other? With perfumes, it's mostly flower smells, isn't it?
Well, no, there's a range. You can have balsamic, the so-called oriental scents. You can have woody notes. You can have more spicy, berry, fruity kind of notes were popular a while back. But smells matter for attraction. They also matter for unattraction. I mean, I've heard quite frequently from people who say, I met this guy, I really liked him. We had a great relationship, except I just couldn't get past how he smelled. So there's that angle to it. And I think the other thing is that pheromones are sort of biological, but humans have the capacity to give meaning to smells. And smell can become eroticized very easily, even the strangest smell. I mean, it's in the same way, no accounting for taste in that category, but you can eroticize any number of body smells or smells that somebody has, and that becomes a key thing for the relationship.
Well, the debate over pheromones involves the fact that our minds can respond to smells that are too weak to be noticed consciously. So we may very well be emitting them and not even being aware that we are or that we're smelling them in another person but still responding.
Exactly. I think a lot of odor perception happens at the margins of awareness. I think smells give a sort of emotional aqua tint to a situation. I think that's where these smell memories are laid down. We're very rarely or seldom aware of memorizing an odor. I'm saying like, okay, I'm going to smell the studio right now and remember the smell. But somehow in the background, it gets taken in, it gets recorded, and then the fact that we recall it years later comes as such a surprise. We sort of fool ourselves.
Why is it so easy to synthesize smells? I mean, a chemist can take a few molecules, put them together, and we have the smell of French fries.
That's only been available in the last 30 years or so, where we can now use very sophisticated instruments in the laboratory to break down to the individual molecule what a complex bouquet like a French fry could be, or a toasted baguette. These are called aroma models, and it takes surprisingly few chemicals to make a realistic high-fidelity version of something. So, for instance, a tomato has 417 different volatile components in it, and yet only about 17 or 18 of them are needed to make a beautifully realistic tomato smell.
There are some vegetables, some foods that don't have much of a smell. Can we enhance their attractiveness by actually adding smells to them?
I talk about that as one of the possibilities for the future. Commercial flowers, especially cut flowers like roses, tend not to be so smelly these days because the breeders have bred for, a rugged, disease-resistant blossom that's showy and colorful and that lasts a long time on the shelf. And what's happened is the smell has not been deliberately bred for, and it's kind of disappeared. So some genetic engineering would be very simple, if you're a genetic engineer, to pop a couple of genes in there and restore the smell of these roses.
Some people speculate that our smelling ability will devolve. Why?
Well, I mean, that's the Freudian idea that it already has devolved. I don't think it has. I think awareness of it might
be
lost.
Why did Freud even wonder about whether our sense of smell devolved?
He thought it was something that children had but that we grew out of, or that, neurotics failed to grow out of. I think it was because he personally had a lousy sense of smell. I looked into his history. He had, he was snorting cocaine. He was having nasal surgery. He had flus, sinus infections, oral cancer. He was a mess medically. So I think he probably stopped smelling in his 30s and just overgeneralized.
Now, there are some smells that almost everybody responds positively to. The smell of a baby, for example. I'm not talking about baby poop, which mothers say doesn't smell as bad to them as it does to strangers, but just you put a baby next to your nose, and I think almost everybody has a very wonderful feeling. Do we have any idea why we have that kind of psychological reaction?
We have some.
Is this hardwired, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's one of the things we're predisposed to like, but it's also cultural. In fact, it's one of the I should mention I'm going to be giving a talk next week where it covers some of these topics. The Purchase College up in Westchester is carrying with the New York Academy of Sciences a whole series on the senses. I think these are the kind of questions that people, I invite them to come and ask. A week from today, actually, at 7 p.m., it's a public event. We'll be talking, me and Stuart Firestein, who's a professor of biology at Columbia University, will be able to answer anybody's questions, so I invite them to come. But these are what I get all the time.
And if people want more information about that event, 7 p.m. at the Performing Arts Center at Purchase, New York, next Monday, they can check out our show page at WNYC.org. The book, What the Nose Knows, The Science of Scent in Everyday Life, is published by Crown. My great thanks to Avery Gilbert for being my guest today.
My pleasure.